Welcome to the debate. Today we are looking at a fascinating and admittedly daunting concept called reflexive civilizational governance. We are drawing this directly from the third paper in the Violence Viability Trilogy, which was authored by Dr. Bechara Saily in analytical collaboration with ChatGPT 5.3.
It is an incredibly ambitious framework. I mean, at its core, it gives us a diagnostic map of human survival, breaking civilizational viability down into this, well, this five-layer architecture. You have the life ground, which is the literal ecological foundation of the planet. Above that is our infrastructure, then our institutions, our epistemic commons.
Which is essentially how we generate, verify, and share knowledge, right?
Exactly. And finally, at the very top, you have our cultural narratives.
And the central question we're wrestling with today emerges right out of that five-layer stack. Can modern human civilizations actually design systems to perceive and, you know, correct our collision course with planetary boundaries? Can we deliberately build a reflexive governance system? Or are the forces of institutional inertia and cultural polarization simply too deeply entrenched to be overcome by rational design? I will be making the case that establishing this reflexive government cycle isn't just some utopian dream. It is a structurally viable and entirely necessary evolutionary step to avert systemic collapse.
And my position is that while the paper's diagnosis of our current systemic drift is absolutely flawless, the proposed cure drastically underestimates the inescapable gravity of our own systems. Institutional inertia and deeply rooted cultural impulses naturally fragment our collective knowledge. We are structurally wired to mask our decline rather than fix it.
To really understand why reflexive governance is feasible, I think we should start with the core analogy the text uses. It compares human societies to biological organisms. If you think about it, a biological organism survives by maintaining physiological balance. It has a nervous system that detects environmental stress, like touching a hot stove, and coordinates an immediate response to pull your hand back. For a civilization, survival depends on the epistemic commons acting as that functional nervous system.
The scientific institutions, the media, the educational networks.
Yes, all of it. They form the cognitive infrastructure that allows us to perceive reality. And the text argues that societies can and must establish a reflexive governance loop. It's a deliberate, iterative cycle. We monitor the life ground, we run that data through rigorous scientific interpretation, we engage in public deliberation, we enact an institutional response, and then, crucially, we monitor the feedback. The premise here is incredibly empowering. Civilizational collapse is not an inevitability. By systematically watching for early warning signals across those five layers, we can consciously steer our civilization out of dangerous systemic drift into what the text calls a basin of resilience. And we can do this long before we cross irreversible ecological thresholds.
The biological analogy is a masterpiece of a diagnostic tool, I'll give you that. Understanding how ecological stress on the life ground moves upward through our infrastructure and into our institutions is brilliant. But let's look at what happens when that planetary nervous system actually tries to function in the real world. The framework accurately identifies our current crisis as one of epistemic degradation and temporal elasticity. And my skepticism is heavily grounded in these two realities.
Let's unpack those terms, because they are heavy.
Right. So temporal elasticity is essentially society's ability to stretch time by borrowing from the future. Modern societies are structurally wired to mask ecological decline. We use massive financial debt, aggressive resource extraction, and technological substitution to create a mirage of stability. We are like the cartoon character who runs off the cliff and keeps running on thin air until he finally looks down. Because of this, expecting an uncorrupted, perfectly functioning epistemic commons to suddenly drive rational long-term policy completely ignores the text's own warnings.
But that assumes the epistemic commons is incapable of piercing that mirage.
Information ecosystems naturally fracture under stress. The text outlines this. They are predictably captured by short-term political survival and vested economic interests. So we are essentially asking a fragmented, heavily compromised nervous system, one that's being pumped full of the painkillers of debt and extraction, to perform perfect planetary surgery on itself.
I get the pessimism, I really do. But treating the current fragmentation of our epistemic commons as an immutable law of nature ignores the sheer technological leap we've made. The material explicitly details our unprecedented scientific capacity to monitor the life ground. Think about how we currently monitor the global climate. We have fleets of satellites tracking atmospheric greenhouse gas concentrations, ocean circulation patterns, methane leaks in real time. We can track hydrological cycles with breathtaking precision.
We definitely have the data. No previous civilization facing collapse had an Excel spreadsheet detailing exactly how fast they were collapsing.
Right, but it's more than just having a spreadsheet. It's the foundation of a new sensory organ for the species. That capability simply did not exist during the fall of Rome or the Maya. By intentionally reinforcing scientific independence, ensuring methodological rigor, and building transparent media infrastructures, we can protect that epistemic commons. If we defend these institutions from capture, we allow those vital ecological constraint signals to propagate upward to the governance layers. We don't need a flawless utopian system. We just need a functional one that integrates empirical knowledge into policy before the basin of stability becomes too shallow to recover from.
The capacity to monitor the life ground is indeed unprecedented. I won't argue with that. But having the data and properly processing it are two vastly different things. Look at the structural reality of the modern informational landscape as detailed in the text. We are operating in an environment characterized by immense digital velocity. Algorithmic recommendation systems and decentralized networks have largely dismantled traditional gatekeeping institutions.
They've certainly decentralized them.
They've decentralized them in a way that financially incentivizes outrage. In this digital environment, the text points out that information ecosystems naturally favor emotional, identity-reinforcing narratives over careful empirical analysis. A highly nuanced, peer-reviewed report on aquifer depletion is never going to go as viral as a 10-second video blaming a marginalized group for water shortages. Epistemic degradation in this context isn't just a temporary lapse in judgment, it is a feature of complex, stressed societies.
So you're saying the nervous system is structurally incentivized to misinterpret the pain signals?
Exactly. As ecological and economic pressures mount, the epistemic commons naturally fragments into parallel interpretive communities. So while the satellite data tracking methane is pristine, the signal generated by that monitoring will almost always be corrupted, delayed, or ideologically contested before it ever reaches the institutional response phase. The pain signal from the burned hand never makes it to the brain because the nervous system is too busy fighting with itself.
That is a severe bottleneck, absolutely. But the text doesn't leave us without a mechanism to bypass that degradation. It specifically outlines the pathway of enhancing institutional adaptability. We can design institutions that bridge the temporal mismatch between short political cycles, which are driven by that digital outrage, and long ecological processes.
How do you practically insulate policy from that kind of volatile public discourse, though?
By institutionalizing foresight. The framework discusses mechanisms for long-term policy planning, things like independent advisory bodies, strategic foresight institutions, and interdisciplinary policy research centers. We can embed the early warning signals directly into the administrative procedures and legal frameworks of our governance systems. Think of it like a central bank. We've largely insulated monetary policy from daily political volatility because we recognize the catastrophic risks of short-term political meddling. The text suggests we can do the exact same thing for planetary management. We can halt systemic drift by legally binding our institutions to the ecological guardrails, limiting the damage that a polarized public discourse can inflict.
Strategic foresight boards sound fantastic in a seminar, but let's bring the concept of temporal elasticity back into the picture. Institutions are fundamentally designed for continuity, predictability, and stability. They operate within procedural frameworks that prioritize incremental change and the negotiation of political compromises. Furthermore, they're deeply embedded with vested interests. We're talking about massive industries, financial actors, and political coalitions that derive immense, immediate benefits from the current regulatory arrangements.
But those vested interests rely on the life ground, too. If the foundation collapses, their wealth collapses.
Eventually, yes.
But temporal elasticity means financial expansion always creates a perceived stability that vastly outlasts actual ecological resilience. An institution facing a resource shortage can buffer that stress temporarily by expanding debt, printing money, or intensifying extraction somewhere else. Because they have that option, they will almost always choose the short-term buffering over the incredibly painful structural reforms required by reflexive governance. When a foresight board's recommendation threatens the immediate quarterly profits of a deeply entrenched industry, institutional inertia will neutralize that board. They will defund it, ignore it, or drown it in bureaucratic review.
But institutional inertia isn't an unbreakable law of physics. It's a design flaw, and it becomes fatal only if left uncorrected. The framework shows us that when the five layers are aligned, they create reinforcing feedback loops that support civilizational resilience. It's a matter of intentionally shifting the underlying incentives.
Shifting them how? The incentives are tied to immediate material reality.
Exactly. Which is why we look at the infrastructure layer. If we integrate ecological considerations into our core infrastructure planning, our water treatment facilities, our energy grids, our agricultural supply chains, we change the material reality that those institutions have to manage. Once resilient, decentralized infrastructure is prioritized, the economic incentives actually begin to align with the life ground rather than working against it. The text points to building resilient infrastructure systems as the practical interface between human societies and the ecological foundations. If you build a power grid that relies entirely on decentralized renewables, the institutional lobbying for fossil fuel subsidies naturally withers. We can consciously re-engineer the system from the ground up to reward long-term stability.
Re-engineering the material infrastructure still requires immense political will. Which brings us right back to how society interprets the need for change in the first place. And this is where the framework's analysis of cultural attractors is so devastating to the idea of a smoothly implemented reflexive governance loop.
Ah, the cultural narratives layer.
Yes, the very top layer. Civilizations don't respond to structural pressures purely through technical or institutional mechanisms. They respond through cultural narratives. The text identifies powerful recurring narrative structures that act as gravity wells or attractors during periods of instability. We have the chosenness myth trauma pattern, the dualism Manichaeism Armageddon pattern, and the repression projection pattern.
Let's ground those in plain English for a second.
Sure. Take the dualism, Manichaeism, Armageddon pattern. It's the classic us versus them, good versus evil narrative. Or the chosenness myth trauma pattern, which builds a national identity entirely around historical grievance and a divine right to resources. Under severe ecological and economic stress, human societies naturally regress into these simplifications. When a society faces a complex crisis like topsoil depletion or a collapsing water table, leaders rarely say, "We need a massive, complex, structural overhaul of our agricultural infrastructure." They externalize the blame. They project internal contradictions onto rival states or marginalized domestic groups, and they demand moral confrontation. It is vastly easier to rally a population around fighting an enemy than it is to rally them around reducing consumption.
That is historically accurate. But the material also explicitly states that cultural narratives are not inherently, inescapably destabilizing. In fact, cultivating adaptive cultural narratives is the fourth crucial pathway for strengthening reflexive governance. Societies also possess deep, rich narrative traditions that emphasize cooperation, stewardship, and mutual responsibility.
But do those positive narratives have the same immediate emotional pull as fear and conflict?
They can, if they are intentionally cultivated. We have historical experiences of collective resilience. We have philosophical and indigenous traditions that recognize the profound interdependence between human communities and the ecological systems they inhabit. We can deliberately foster these adaptive narratives through our educational institutions, cultural organizations, and public discourse. By continuously emphasizing shared planetary responsibility, we can counter the divisive polarization that drives those destructive cultural attractors. It requires intentional cultivation, yes. It is hard work, but it is entirely within our capacity as a conscious, meaning-making species to choose a different story.
The capacity exists, certainly, but we have to look at the dynamics of how these narratives actually compete during a crisis. The text notes that cultural attractors like the us versus them mentality are particularly influential because they draw upon deep reservoirs of historical memory. They provide immediate, emotionally satisfying explanations for systemic stress. Cultivating a top-down, adaptive narrative of planetary stewardship requires a highly functioning epistemic commons to legitimize it in the public mind.
Which loops us back to protecting the scientific and media institutions.
Right. But as we've already established, that commons is fragmented by digital velocity. When public discourse is dominated by identity-based struggles, the space for nuanced analysis and long-term cooperative planning narrows drastically. The failure modes outlined in the text are mutually reinforcing. Ecological stress triggers the cultural attractors, which polarize the epistemic commons, which paralyzes the institutions, which in turn accelerates the ecological stress. It's a downward spiral.
It is a profound negative feedback loop. But let's look at the concept of the reflexive turn introduced in the paper. This is crucial. The reflexive turn describes a historical moment at which civilizations begin to develop a genuine capacity for systemic self-awareness. It does not imply that we suddenly become perfectly rational or free from political conflict. It simply means we expand our collective capacity to incorporate knowledge about systemic conditions into our actual decision-making.
But hasn't humanity always tried to do that to some degree?
Locally, yes. But we have transitioned into a genuinely planetary civilization where local decisions have immediate global consequences and global ecological changes immediately affect local stability. The sheer unprecedented scale of this interdependence forces the reflexive turn. We are already seeing the emergence of cross-sector coordination and international frameworks attempting to monitor these boundaries. Think about global treaties on ozone depletion or current negotiations on plastic pollution. It is an uneven, contested, and messy emergence, as the text readily admits. But the reflexive governance loop is beginning to form. We are finally learning to observe our own systemic impact on the life ground.
Observing the impact and structurally adapting to it are two vastly different things. The text describes a civilizational stability landscape, where societies occupy positions defined by how well their institutions align with the life ground. Because of the temporal elasticity we discussed, the financial mechanisms, the debt, the technological substitutions, we are currently wandering across a tipping ridge.
The edge of the basin of resilience.
Exactly. The perceived stability is high. The stock market might be up, the grocery store shelves might be full, but the actual ecological resilience holding that structure up is silently collapsing beneath us. The diagnostic tools in Appendix A of the material are profound. They offer ways of assessing life ground integrity, infrastructure resilience, and institutional adaptability. They highlight exactly how misaligned we are. But identifying the early warning signals of systemic drift, like widening social inequality and increasing ecological volatility, doesn't automatically grant the institutions the power to overcome their own embedded interests. Knowing you are wandering on a tipping ridge does not magically grant you the political consensus required to safely walk back down into the basin of stability.
Yet without that precise knowledge, walking back down is entirely impossible. That is the fundamental value of the epistemic commons and the five-layer architecture. It maps the terrain for us. The framework proves that reflexive self-regulation is structurally possible. If we deliberately protect our knowledge institutions, insulate our scientific interpretation from immediate political capture, and consciously align our infrastructure with the life ground, we can execute the reflexive governance loop. The existence of failures at the interpretation or public deliberation stages does not negate the viability of the architecture itself.
It just highlights how steep the climb is.
Precisely. It points to exactly where our interventions must be targeted. Civilizational collapse is a choice born of willful blindness. By establishing this unified viability map, we are prying open the eyes of the system.
I will certainly agree that the map is a masterpiece of systemic diagnosis. The way the text integrates Galting's theory of structural violence with McMurtry's life value philosophy creates something truly unique.
For the audience, that essentially means combining the understanding that our systems inherently do harm to marginalized groups, structural violence, with the imperative that we must structurally prioritize life over profit.
Exactly. It's a profound diagnostic framework. We are in complete agreement on the catastrophic risks of systemic drift and the brilliant clarity of the five-layer model. However, to summarize my position, while the diagnostic tools are unparalleled, the failure modes mapped within the text are likely too powerful to allow for a smoothly functioning planetary nervous system. Human institutions are bound by their own structural gravity. Under the immense pressure of ecological constraints, they are far more likely to double down on short-term buffering, debt expansion, and narrative warfare than they are to achieve true, selfless reflexivity.
And to summarize my stance, the five-layer architecture demonstrates that while the challenges are immense, human civilizations are not passive victims of systemic drift. We are not just passengers on a sinking ship. Reflexive governance is an achievable evolutionary step. By strengthening the integrity of the epistemic commons, enhancing institutional adaptability through foresight, building resilient infrastructure, and consciously cultivating cultural narratives of stewardship, we can form a functioning regulatory cycle. We can learn to regulate our interactions with the planetary systems that sustain us. Our disagreement today clearly remains firmly on whether human institutions can actually overcome their own structural inertia to implement this reflexivity before we cross those irreversible ecological thresholds.
The vehicle is incredibly heavy, and the steering is severely compromised by the passengers fighting over the wheel.
It is a profound tension, and one that requires deep reflection from all of us. There is immense value in examining our societal structures through this unified viability map. For those looking to understand the precise mechanics of how this planetary monitoring and adaptation might actually work in practice, I highly suggest exploring the source material further. Appendix A in particular offers a fascinating, highly practical diagnostic framework for assessing lifeground integrity, institutional adaptability, and the overall health of the epistemic commons.
It is absolutely essential reading for anyone trying to understand the deeper underlying structural forces behind the daily cascade of ecological and political crises we see on the news.
We will leave it to the listener to decide whether human civilization can ultimately learn to steer itself, repair its epistemic nervous system, and achieve reflexive governance before crossing the ultimate ecological thresholds. Thank you for joining us on The Debate.